Welcome, everyone.
Welcome
to You're Gonna Need a Bigger Bottle. That was a lot. It continues to go on. It's a podcast about movies and wine. And for people who don't know shit about one or both of those things, I'm Jamie. I'm the movie guy.
No, you're not.
Yeah, I'm the wine guy.
You're the wine guy. Guy watches fucking one reading. Movie on Hulu last weekend, and he's all of a sudden the movie guy. I'm Jamie. I have a Hulu subscription. I watch Spencer. I'm the movie guy now.
I'm the wine guy. Correction. Redacted the other thing. I'm the wine guy.
He is the wine guy, as anyone who listens to this show would know. I am the movie guy. I am Scott. And we, James and I, are here to help you. Each episode, we pair a movie that I love with a wine that he loves.
We tell you why we like them, how they're made, and why they work. Hopefully, we find a pairing that works. Usually, we don't.
We almost never do.
Sometimes we do.
We almost never do. That's what almost never means. It means sometimes.
God damn it, Scott.
It's what it means. Anyway, today we are continuing on with part 7 of our 52-part year-long miniseries, Pinot Grigio versus The Matrix Resurrections. I'm just fucking with you, audience. You guys thought you were out, and then I almost got you.
No, but you're actually out.
We're done talking about The Matrix Resurrections and Pinot Grigio. For a little while. We're doing a palate cleanser today. We did a 6-part miniseries. Prior to that, we did what should have been a 6-part miniseries, and I think ended up being a 9-part miniseries about the end of the world. We had a 2-part Oscar digression, and now before we dive into our next probably 6-part semi-loosely connected thematic series on wine and or movies, we're taking a break. We're doing a one-off, something quick, get you in, easy and out, just like this introduction that's totally not going too long.
We're very good at podcasting, everybody.
Extremely good at it, yes. So today we are talking about a recent movie, a new movie.
Brand spanking new.
We're talking about 2022's The Batman, also known as Le Batman or J-Batman in certain circles, namely just the circles in my head. This is a film written and directed by Matt Reeves. It stars Robert Pattinson, The Pats, Zoe Kravitz, Jeffrey Wright, Paul Dano, Colin Farrell, Andy Serkis, John Turturro, and Peter Sarsgaard. It just dropped on HBO Max this week that you're listening to it. In theory, probably, as of the time we're recording this, HBO Max hasn't officially confirmed that it's releasing, but it seems like based on their current 45-day release strategy that they want to juice the numbers and they're going to sacrifice the last few weeks of the tail of the movie's box office and dump it on the streamers. But it may also still be in theaters. Either way, check it out because it's good. It's undisputably good. Everyone on this show loves it, and I think you guys will like it too.
It's good. And I'll stop there for right now.
Jamie's had a bit of a turnaround. Very interesting.
I have not had a turnaround.
I mean, you just said it was good, which was a far cry from your response after we saw it.
We'll get into it.
We will. Jamie, I said many things about this movie. You have seen this movie. We collectively came up with pairing words to try and drive your creative some 13% soaked brain to make a pairing. What are we drinking? And why is it so red?
Well, if my brain is 13% soaked, this wine is quite a bit more soaked. This is the 15.5% alcohol, at least on the label, although I suspect it's a little bit higher. Tommaso Bussola, Valpolicella Ripasso Classico Superiore Cadelaito. Lots of Italian words. So this is a Corvina, Corvinone, and Rondinella blend. Coming from the Veneto region of Italy in the northeast of the country.
That's a Corvina, Corvinone, and what?
Rondinella.
And those are all grapes.
They are, yes.
And this is a blend of those three grapes.
And a small amount of other grapes that are not really worth mentioning.
And you suspect that there's fraud happening on the label and this is a higher alcohol than 15.5.
U.S. and EU law allow a swing of 1% in labeling, and they allow that for whatever volatility happens in the bottle or during bottling. So you can label something at, 14%, and if it comes in at 14.9, you're still legally okay.
All right. Well, that's nice that they have margins there.
Yeah.
I just assume that the European standard would be you have to come in at exactly what your label says. Otherwise, you and your whole family go to jail for 100 years for violating the sanctity of these fucking religiously important laws.
Yeah, no, the European standard is actually more lax because they can label a range. And there are a bunch of European wines that'll come in labeled 11 to 14% alcohol. Making you guess. Yep, it's very accurate. Very helpful.
Well, before we get into it, we have a little bit of business. While we don't have any new reviews today, we do have the incomplete results of an extremely important social media poll. Jamie, why don't you share with people what the results are?
So on both Twitter and Instagram, we put out the question, should Jamie, me, be allowed to describe myself as hype?
The subject verb agreement in that sentence was really egregious. Can we
super
try that?
Super bad,
can
but
we
you know what? Again? We're going to roll with it because I don't give a shit.
Fuck. So is Jamie, a 37-year-old man, allowed to self-describe as hype? Is the question.
And the answer, generally speaking, from very, very few respondents, is
right.
Yes, I am allowed to say hype.
I have a bone to pick here, sir.
I'm shocked that, by this,
that
Scott.
Is,
I'm
at, that is
picture
actually,
my utter shock that you have a bone to pick.
That is actually not the answer, Jamie. What is the question being posed? Literally read it to me. What is the text of the question that you put out?
The text of the question, hold on, let me open this up. On Twitter, can Jamie describe himself as hype?
Okay.
And the two possible answers are hype, exclamation point, and not remotely hype, period.
And what does it say on Instagram?
It says, what do y'all think? Is hype appropriate for use by a 37-year-old man?
Okay, so first of all, you're asking two different questions, which is just me being semantic, but you are asking two different questions. One of them is Jamie allowed to describe himself as hype? And the other is a hypothetical 37-year-old man allowed to describe himself as hype? Two different
Correct.
Questions. So you're already murkying the results. Also, you pose to the audience a yes or no question, and then the options that you give them when answering are neither yes nor no.
People understood what they were voting for.
I genuinely don't think that they do. How much time do you commit to Instagram or Twitter polls when you see them? Do you really carefully read the wording that much, or do you just look at a thing and say, all right, I'm going to hit a button?
Well, I mean, I feel like the hype exclamation point is very self-explanatory.
I don't know. Maybe somebody just very quickly skimmed at it and saw, is Jamie hype or not hype? And they hit hype because they think that you're hype.
Well, I am hype.
But we don't know because we don't have conclusive results from
Scotty,
from the followers.
I'm hype. It's okay for me to use the word hype. I'm going to stay on your lawn.
All right. According to 19 people, when asked yes or no, can Jamie, a 37-year-old man, use the word hype to self-describe, most of them said hype in response. Not yes,
yeah,
nor
correct.
No, just hype.
And those people are hype for me to use the word hype.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think you really fucked that one up. And I think you owe people an apology, starting with me.
I apologize for nothing to no one.
Title of your memoir.
There you go.
All right. So we got that nonsense out of the way. Let's start with movie. Let's start with movie.
Movie. This movie.
This movie. The Batman. Not a Batman. Not some Batman. Not Batman without a definitive article. The Batman.
J-Batman, J-apostrophe Batman.
Right. Which means nothing to anyone except me and you, and that's it. That's all.
And a small number of our friends.
Oh, I guess Jabai was Oakley's, right?
Oakley that was
coined
Oakley.
Jabai. And I have always enjoyed Jabai. Strangely French possessive conjugation of goodbye,
goodbye.
In English. But I also enjoyed on a relatively recent My Brother and Me episode, Travis McElroy, the Middleist brother, described our current president as Joe Biden. And that for me has really is where Joe Batman came from, is from Joe Biden.
So I always thought that you referring to Joe Biden as Joe Biden came from Jabai.
No. This is 100% a McElroy's thing. This is just me stealing and now finally attributing their bit. Yeah, Joe Biden just made me giggle, as most things those silly boys say on their show does.
I mean, it made me giggle when you said it, but also like it made me giggle as a callback to our dumb friend Oakley saying
right.
the dumb thing. Okay, talk about Joe Batman.
Yes. So yeah, I love it. That's why I wanted to talk about it. I love it. Yeah, Jamie made a fart noise. He said it was good 20 minutes ago. Now he made a fart noise. I was extremely skeptical going in. I think as I've been pretty clear about on the show previously, I'm kind of exhausted by superhero movies in general, and especially by big screen Batman or Batman, especially of the dark, brooding, hyper violent urban Avenger loner type of Batman. But the Robert Pattinson casting intrigued me because that guy has impeccable taste. And if he is going to attach himself to another big franchise, like maybe there's something that's actually interesting there. And I'm a big fan of Matt Reeves' Planet of the Apes movies. And so I went in very, very cautiously optimistic, even though I really didn't want it to exist. And I was floored by it. I have seen it now theatrically twice, and a lot of my issues with it the first time have kind of been smoothed over by a second viewing. I really love the style. I love the mood and the atmosphere and the sense of place. I love that it's a Batman movie that's actually about Batman, which is not normally the case. Normally it's about the villains and then Batman shows up, or like in the Nolan movies, it's about the villains and Batman is there as like a super literal thematic representation and not really a character. But yeah, I love that it's about Batman, that it gets you emotionally invested in the character. I love that it is not really in what has become this like codified superhero genre. Like it is a detective movie that has Batman in it. And I really miss when superhero movies weren't a genre, when they were just, because like in comics, superheroes are not really a genre. Like all of those characters exist in their own genres. And in this like post, let's say post 2002 Sam Raimi Spider-Man world, like they have increasingly been codified into one genre with all of its trappings. And this is not that. It's a detective movie. It's a murder mystery serial killer urban corruption movie that has a Batman in it. I love that it's sexy, that it's like super sexy and a little bit romantic. I could have gone with some more of that, but you know, these things are so like anodyne and anesthetized lately, and like, oh yeah, this is hot and there's two hot people and they clearly want to be hot together, and I could go for more of that in these movies. I love that it's trying to actually engage with the real world in a tangible, earnest way, even if I think it's kind of murky about it. And I love that it doesn't feel like what film critic Matt Seitz has called movie flavored product. It's a fucking movie. I'm exhausted by the Marvel driven superhero movie trend, but I would totally be okay with more of these movies if more of them were like this, if they were actual movies, if they were cinema with real vision and style and a specific take on the characters that feel like the work of a singular filmmaker with their own vision and not the work of a committee. That is my treatise on The Batman. I like that it's a movie, which feels like the fucking barest minimum to ask for one of these things.
Yeah, and yet we don't get it so often.
No.
So starting with the things that I like about it, I like that it's a movie also, and I like that it takes a swing and that it has a point of view. I fully agree with you on that, even though I walked out of the theater completely underwhelmed. I would take this over... I mean, the last Batman movie I saw was Dark Knight Rises, but I would take this one over any of the Chris Nolan Batman any day, because I hated those movies. And I also like that it has a genre that's not superhero movie, and that we actually are invested in the hero character. I think Pattinson's Batman is interesting. I don't necessarily connect, but there's a lot of meat there. I do not like the style or the mood of it. You know, we've talked about this before. I like whimsy in movies, like any at all. And especially when we're talking about superheroes, like it feels so stupid to live in a world where this is so fucking serious. I'm willing to engage, but after, you know, it's a 3-hour movie that I feel lacks the sexiness and heat and chemistry that you seem to think exists. And I just cannot connect emotionally to really any character except for Pattinson at certain points. And it just takes such a long walk to get where it's going. I walked out of there like profoundly underwhelmed.
Well, Jamie, you're forgetting one thing. You did like John Turturro. That was the only thing you said in our post men's room conversation in the lobby. Was you were like, I like John Turturro. John Turturro's good.
John Turturro nailed it. He's real good.
John Turturro is really fucking good in the movie. I love Turturro. All right. Well, I don't agree with really anything that you said, but I think it's interesting your take on it, and we'll get into it all a little bit more. I think for me, why I was so compelled to pick this movie to talk about for the show, just first of all, like, it's been a while since you and I have disagreed about something.
For sure.
The movie half of our Matrix discussions were it was a lot of, you know, agreement from two different voices.
Yeah, isn't that cool? It was so awesome when...
I mean, that was mostly you, and then I was talking about, like, craft and form and French philosophy and all kinds of things that people love. But largely, we agreed about the movie. And then you would say it was cool, and I liked when that happened. But the other reason that I wanted to talk about it is that we had wildly divergent takes on it, and as I've found with a lot of the reviews that I've read of this movie, is that I don't actually disagree with any of the negative marks against it. Like, I don't share your viewpoint, but I don't think you're wrong. And it's, I think the movie is weirdly kind of a litmus test. It's one of those things where, like, I don't know, if I had come to it in a different time in my life, I might have liked it more, or I might have liked it a lot less. I kind of think about it on a spectrum with Dune, a movie that, like, Johnny Words and I, as we've talked about on the show, like, dear friend of ours, Johnny Words, supporter of the show, where we just, like, fundamentally disagreed about the movie. And it came down to him being like, man, I'm really bummed that you couldn't enjoy it. I'm like, yeah, me too, because everything you're describing sounds like shit that I would love. And it just doesn't feel like the movie that I saw. But yeah, I think it all takes on this are legitimate. And I see what you're saying about what you perceive to be its failures. And I don't agree, but I totally get why you see it that way. It's an interesting movie, and we'll find where we go.
I think it's interesting too, and it's a thing that I talk about a bunch when I'm talking to people about wine, and people ask me, you know, is it a good wine or a bad wine? And if you like it, it's probably a good wine. Taste is so subjective, as is our perception of the stories that we're told. And in a similar way to, you know, you not agreeing with me about the specific points that I've made, I disagree with you, but I also can see that this is a well-crafted movie that has intent and thought, and I respond to that at the very least. And there are plenty of good things out there that I don't particularly care for, and plenty of bad things that I love.
I don't think
Bad
I
Boys
like...
Bad Boys 2, not a great movie.
Bad Boys 2 is complicated. Bad Boys 2 is really complicated. But we're not here to talk about Michael Bay. We're here to talk about Jabatman and wine.
That's right.
And I have already drank my whole glass, so I'm going to pour some more and give you some of my detailed, thoughtful notes. Jamie, why don't you tell the kids at home briefly why you picked this wine? Not because of the pairing words, just what you like about it.
So in the continuing narrative of me picking wines that I've worked with a bunch in the past, this is Tommaso Bussola. This has graced wine lists that I've worked on really since I started my career in wine, from, you know, their regular old Valpolicella to the Ripasso, all the way up to the really expensive Amarones. These wines, I think, are really exciting, partly because of the way they taste and the elegance that they show while still being these brooding, kind of brutish, huge monster wines. These wines for me are kind of like whenever you hear a story about an NFL player that has to take ballet lessons in order to be more nimble. That's what I think of when I think of the Bussola wines.
Is that an actual thing? Because I have only ever heard of that in the context of you using it as a metaphor for wine.
Yeah, it's an actual thing.
Okay.
To my knowledge, anyway. I've never seen it, but, like, also I have an image of, like, a football player in full contact gear and also a tutu in my head, and that makes me laugh.
That gives you the gigs, yeah. That's fair.
It does. And that's kind of what I feel about this wine and about the whole line of Bussola wines. I also love that we're in a region where there is, like, a really bifurcated conversation. And the champions of the conversation are two really extremely high-end wines that are very inaccessible and extremely, extremely expensive. We talked in our, I think it was The Widow. No, not The Widows.
Jamie,
Marriage
it's,
Story.
It's just Widows. It's not The Widows. Drop the. It's cleaner.
All right, Sean Parker. We talked about, not on Widows episode, but on the Marriage Story episode, Arnaldo Capri. And that region, Montefalco in Umbria, is bifurcated between the modernist, which is Capri, and the traditionalist, or the more natural producer, which is Paolo Bea. Here in the Veneto, it's bifurcated in a very similar way, except on in an even more extreme high-end way, more extreme by like a couple of $100 per bottle, the top end being Del Forno on the modernist side and Giuseppe Quintarelli on the traditional side. And Bussola is spoken of in conversation with both of those wineries and sort of straddles the line between the styles, and also is in a generally pretty accessible price point for the region. So all of those things excite me about this particular bottle of wine.
Well, I happen to enjoy the flavor and the smell of the wine. I can't really talk about all of this conceptual wine industry nonsense that you do, but I, at least, when I enjoy a wine, I enjoy it because of the way it looks and the way it smells, and especially the way that it tastes, Jamie. Call me a traditionalist, I guess, but I prefer my wines to taste good and not just be metatextually interesting.
I mean, it's my baseline that I'm picking wines that I think are delicious. So it's easier for me to just move past that and talk about the other things about it.
All right.
Yes, I think this wine is delicious.
Can I tell you my thoughts? I have thoughts. I have lots of them.
Go ahead.
I didn't write them down, but I formulated them last night, and hopefully I'll remember them all. So on the nose, I'm getting tomato.
Like a fresh tomato?
Come on, man. Give me a break here. I'm getting like tomato. Okay. Tomato? Maybe stewed.
Like ketchup?
Yes, it's ketchup. I'm getting ketchup. On the palate, less ketchup and more steak sauce, getting some of that like zingy tang of steak sauce.
Yeah.
There's cherries. Tani was saying she was getting in something in the ballpark of plums. I don't know about that. There's like a dark chocolate note. I was getting like a, on the nose, like a funky, wet, damp, earthy thing that I don't feel 100% about this. I'm not 100% there, but there's a hint or a smell of wet mulch that I was getting, a funky earthen thing. It smells real good.
I think there's a lot more fruit than you're giving it credit for. There's a lot of those savory things, but there's also this like really ripe, like baked plum, baked black cherry kind of jam.
I said cherry. I said there were cherries.
Well, maybe I was just ignoring you because you were talking so much about steak sauce. Although I do think that this
steak sauce
that you hit the nail on the head. I fully agree. Like A1 steak sauce.
Yeah. It's a little salty too.
It's real big. It's real powerful, but it still has like, I know that you hate it when I get really like metaphorical about it, but it has this acidity that makes it feel like it's on point. You know, like in the way that a ballerina is on point,
like it sort of up on the toes
down your palate.
Yeah. I'm again, unable to discern acidity in red wine. It just baffles me. I think it's the presence of the tannin that just throws me off, and I can't discern acidity.
There's also a lot of tannin in this wine.
There is, but not too much. Is it what we say medium plus? Cause it's not, I'm not feeling like scraped raw by the texture of this.
Yeah. Medium plus. It's these real fine grain tannins that aren't, they don't scrape you raw. They're not too aggressive, but they're definitely present and persistent. And they kind of dominate the finish of the wine, even as the acidity makes you salivate. You're still kind of drying out from those tannins.
Yeah. There's like a black coffee note too. Maybe that's how I'm discerning acidity. Something about like, you know, a dark, like, I don't know, sitting all day on the burner, pot of black coffee, almost like burnt coffee.
Oof. That like camping percolator coffee.
Yeah, exactly. It's not good, but like you made it with your own labor and you're too tired to give a shit, like kind of black coffee.
Yep.
Camping food is the best because it's just like, it's the best way to grade cooking on a curve because nobody can complain because fuck you. What are you going to do? Go to Wendy's? You're in the woods. I'm a big fan. I love the color of it. It's purple, a purpley dark wine.
Yep.
And the body is, you like your light bodied reds. I would say this is like a medium minus. It's not fully light bodied, but it's not as viscous as I typically prefer in my dark reds.
I would put this at medium plus to high as far as body is concerned.
Well, I disagree, sir.
It's pretty big. It fills your mouth up.
Well, because I take big sips, Jamie.
That's not what I mean, and we've been over this.
Hang on, this is a perfect opportunity. So this is a recurring segment on the show, the Johnny Words Memorial segment, in honor of Johnny Words, dear friend of the show, who recently expressed to us, yes, in memoriam, he's totally dead, but he recently expressed that one of his favorite things on the show is when I, acting as an audience advocate, ask Jamie to explain something that he has explained before. Johnny Words thinks it's very helpful and thinks that my questions are thoughtful and probing, and he thinks that Jamie does not do a good job of describing things, and Johnny Words really appreciates when I interrogate Jamie and ask him to explain things over and over and over again.
I really hope that the audience is reading your just dripping, disgusting sarcasm now.
I'm being very sincere. I'm being extremely sincere. I want to dedicate this to the memory and honor of our dear friends. Well, I guess we should. I was going to say his real name, but I don't want to expose him because he's a man of his privacy. So I'll make up a fake, stupid name that there's no way could possibly be his real name. So in honor of Johnny Words, a.k.a. Dan Marino.
That's correct. Yes.
I dedicate this question to you, Jamie, which is how can it fill my mouth more just by having higher body?
As I said before, when we were talking about this in another episode, I think it was the Widow's episode, because we were talking about the full-bodied nature of that Chardonnay, the Domaine La Roche.
Chardonnay.
I likened it to the difference of taking an equal-sized bite of a flank steak versus a ribeye steak. The flank steak is lean, and it obviously volumetrically will fill your mouth exactly the same as the piece of ribeye. But the ribeye has so much fat that it almost oozes over your teeth and just gives you more of a sense that your mouth is full, whether or not it's actually true. And that is what I'm talking about in this wine. It's the difference between flank or ribeye. It's the difference between skim milk or whole milk.
Because the fat coats your mouth more and gives the illusion of more surface contact, just because it clings with its fattiness.
Correct.
Wonderful. Thank you for explaining it. This concludes this episode segment of Johnny Words Likes It When Scott Asks Questions That Jamie Has Answered Previously. Anyway. Are there any things that I missed in my description of this wine's flavors, or should we move along to how we tried to pair?
I think we've talked a lot about it. You talked about the dank earth, the mulchiness of it.
It's dank, Jamie. What about the dank?
It's definitely dank. It's fully agree with you. It's got that. It's like wet, almost fermented soil. I think there's the mulch note in it, but I also think there's like a early spring moss covered kind of like in a wooded area with decaying leaves kind of note to this wine, which I know is very, very mouthwatering and appealing to all of our listeners, but trust me, this wine is delicious.
Yeah. Rotting vegetative matter is always appealing to me. Definitely makes me hungry.
Ever take a walk in the woods after a really rainy day and there's like a chill in the air because it's early spring. Everything's wet and you smell the decay, but it's the decay as an extant form of life. Like the forest is coming back alive because it's springtime and things are, despite the chill in the air, still getting warmer. It's that. That's what I'm trying to describe.
Wow. No is my answer to that very long question. No, I don't think I've ever done that. And then simultaneously detected that particular scent and had that ephemeral experience you just described. But you know what?
It's still chilly and early spring, so we should go for a walk in the woods, you and I.
Shut up. I'm not going anywhere with you. It's early spring. I have a small, mossy, muddy path right near my house on our property, and it rained a lot yesterday. So I will go and do that later, and I will report back to you. For sure, I'm not going to forget to do this.
You definitely won't have had too much wine after this recording and need a nap.
For sure. I don't nap after the wine, Jamie. I like do other things.
You should nap. It's a really good nap.
I have other things to do, man. There is a small human who is dependent upon me.
Yeah, he'll be fine.
No, he won't. All right.
Are we ready to move on?
Yes. So we collectively described Jabatman as maximalist, grungy, red, I specifically noted like a deep ruby or garnet, bold/medium+, tannin/dry, self-important, haunted, self-contained, assured, wears its references openly, and petrichor, because it's always raining in Gotham City. I was pretty pleased with myself for that one.
I'm sure you were.
Yeah, and then you had to be a dick about it. All right, so let's start at the top. Maximalist. Now, maximalism, or the opposite of minimalism, or an aesthetic of excess, right? So on describing the movie, the style, the aesthetic is very bold. It takes some pretty big aesthetic choices for a movie in general, but especially this type of movie. And it puts those stylistic choices front and center. There's a lot of them. It is a strong commitment to a very dynamic aesthetic there. And the things I'm talking about are the movie has very dramatic lensing choices. You're very aware of, or at least I was very aware of.
What is dramatic lensing?
So they use these really old lenses. Okay. They wanted to have a 1970s noir look. And so even though they were shooting on digital with the Alexa LF large format camera, because so much of the movie is shot at night and you get a lot of more latitude and low light photography with one of those. But they use these what are considered broken anamorphic lenses from the 70s that have great distortion. So the center of the image.
Why are they considered to be broken?
Well, because of the distortions that come with them. Briefly, anamorphic is how widescreen is achieved, 235, or now it's 239.1, very widescreen is achieved, where the size and the shape of the film frame or the camera sensor is the same, but the lens itself has geometric distortions in it so that what comes into the lens and the sensor is a stretched vertical image. But then when you project it back out through an anamorphic projection lens, or if you algorithmically shift it in your digital intermediary, doing a digital workflow in post-production, you basically stretch it back down vertically. And so you get these weird spherical warping images, which is how that has always been achieved. And now they're doing it in different digital ways. And sometimes they just crop, which looks like ass. But so the distortions that you get in this, not only do you get the spherical blurring at the edges, but there's a lot of fall off in terms of the depth of field. It's a very, very, very shallow depth of field that they're doing, which is a little bit separate from the lenses. There's a silhouetting quality.
I'm sorry. Usually you're the one who's being the audience advocate, but just for those out there who don't know what depth of field is.
Yeah. So depth of field is how much is in focus. And this movie has a very shallow depth of field. So when Batman is in close up, if his eyes are in focus, his nose probably isn't, and the sides of his head are not, and everything behind him is very blurry. If you have deep focus, it means that everything in the image is in focus, and a shallow focus or a shallow depth of field means that only one narrow sliver or one plane along the Z-axis is in focus. And that's an aesthetic choice that they really commit to hard.
Does a shallow depth of field for you communicate anything in particular?
It can communicate a lot. It in this movie, I think in particular, it communicates subjectivity.
Got it.
So much of the movie is about the point of view of Batman, and also the point of view of our, serial killing, corruption exposing Riddler character played by Paul Dano. I almost think the shallow depth of field in the film is a little bit monotonous. They do it a little bit too much. That's part of the maximalism. It's a very strong stylistic choice to go that shallow and to commit that hard to it. And I think they maybe do it a little bit too much, but it does lead to some incredibly compelling and arresting images. Another part of the maximalism, committing to a strong style, is there's a very intense focus on point of view. There's a lot of POV shots. I'm thinking particularly of the scene where Selina, never actually called Catwoman, Zoe Kravitz, is walking through the underground, corruption, crime bosses and political muckety mucks, essentially prostitution dance club. And she's got on Batman's Tom Cruise Mission Impossible camera lenses. And we see things from her point of view. We see literally her POV. There's a lot of scenes like that, or when Batman first enters the crime scene at the opening of the movie when the mayor is murdered, and we are his POV walking down an entire corridor filled with cops giving him the stink eye. There's a lot of things like that where it's committed to a POV in subjectivity, but then also in camera placement, like when, by the way, spoilers, if just spoilers, we're going to talk about all of it, but like in the, when Batman has to escape police headquarters and he does like the squirrel suit, wingsuit thing, and the commitment to a POV and to naturalism or some kind of artificial naturalism is so strong that the camera is either mounted to a building watching him, or it is through digital trickery mounted to his head or to his foot. And they do the same trick in the Batmobile chase, where like most of that chase, other than a couple of objective wide shots, are in the car or mounted to the car or to the Penguin's car. Like, it's not the way you would normally film a car chase, but it's this like hard commitment to, we want to put you in his face, we want to put you in the subjective experience of it. And that's, I just think that's a really big swing. And then the other thing with the maximalism is just the sound. It's a very dynamic sound design and sound mix, a lot of highs, a lot of lows, like very, very, very intense peaks and valleys and subjectivity in the actual sound mix and the sound design. And then that fucking score, that Michael Giacchino score, he's been one of my favorites since he came onto the scene. But holy shit, that score is easily his best work. And it's big and dramatic and operatic. And it's not small. It's not subtle or naturalistic or minimalistic. And the movie goes fucking hard. It goes real hard.
It does go extraordinarily hard. You're very right.
So that to me is the maximalism of the film.
Yes. And you would, maximalism is generally a thing that I respond to. I like a lot of things. I just, for whatever reason, didn't respond to a lot in this movie.
Well, but it's like, it's a style, right? Like it's still, maximalism is, it's about volume, right? And it's about quantity more than the actual style.
Right.
The maximalism of Wes Anderson, I imagine, appeals to you a lot more than the maximalism of the Batman.
Yeah, I really liked the French Dispatch.
Right. Oh God, that French Dispatch.
That was
so
a
good.
Lot of fun to watch.
We were just talking about him. Michael Bay. Michael Bay is like one of the maximalists, you know?
Right.
I don't know anybody who likes maximalism as like in general. Like it's all about how much do you enjoy that style and then how much do you enjoy seeing it cranked up to 11.
That, yeah. I would imagine there are a lot of people out there who don't like maximalism just generally, like don't like it being turned up to 11, even if they like the style. But speaking of maximalism.
Yeah. So what about this wine? Hang on. I should probably commit the name of it to memory.
It's going to be tough. There are a lot of Italian words.
What about the Valpolicella Ripazzo is maximalist?
I'm going to kill you.
Jamie, Batman's kind of a cop. I think this is a good pairing. You saw police on the bottle and you thought Batman's kind of a cop.
That's not I literally did not register that police is in the name of this wine until I brought you the bottle.
All right,
last
Jamie,
week.
Get your anti-Italian gesticulating hand ready. Let's hear it. Let's hear you say it.
So the wine is, and I already did it at the beginning of the episode, but just for those of you who want to hear it again, this is the Bussola Valpolicella Ripasso Classico Superiore Cadelaito 2017. The Valpolicella region is interesting in the world of wine. We have talked a little bit on this show about both sherry and champagne as places that are driven very much by technique. Valpolicella is another place that is driven very much by technique. We have a relatively cool continental climate here, and you would think, generally speaking, that the wines would be restrained and elegant and lighter in body, but because of the way they make wine here, these wines are pretty monstrous. This particular wine I would not necessarily describe as monstrous, but it is a monster version of what the grapes will give you alone without the technique applied. The most prestigious and most expensive type of wine from this region is called Amarone, or Amarone della Valpolicella. And the way you make Amarone is you harvest the grapes as you normally would harvest grapes, and then you lay them on straw mats in a very well-ventilated, frequently mechanically ventilated with fans room called a fruttai, and you dry those grapes out for roughly 3 months. So you have raisins. And this is a method that's used sort of the world over to make dessert wine, because when you remove the moisture from grapes, you have obviously higher sugar to volume ratio.
So you get concentrated sugar juice.
Correct. So you can ferment to a certain point and leave a bunch of sugar behind, hence a dessert wine. This is done in the Northern Rhone, and it's called vin de paille, or straw wine. It's done in Austria, where it's called Strohwein. Exactly the same process, dried on straw mats, except here, rather than stopping fermentation prior to the wine going dry, the wine is fermented entirely dry. That extra sugar gets turned into extra alcohol. So Amarones can clock in anywhere from 15.5% all the way up to 18%, which is really where fortified wine levels start to be. So you have to have like a pretty strong yeast strain in order to ferment all the way to that high alcohol level. What that also means is that you have really concentrated flavors. You have this like bombastic sort of raisinated baked fruit character. They tend to be really earthy. They tend to age forever. And because of the nature of these grapes, that's all balanced out by this really like intense acidity. So that's Amarone. And I think the case there is obvious for maximalism. Like you're taking these grapes that would ordinarily make a lightish body, really balanced red wine and turning it into Frankenstein's monster. But then after you press the Amarone, you have your spent Amarone skins. You put those skins in with another fermentation tank that has been just regularly crushed grapes, and that's called ripasso. So you're taking the used skins from your Amarone and using them to beef up your regular Valpolicella, giving you Valpolicella ripasso. So by another method, turning that what could be a really light-bodied, easygoing wine into a different kind of monster. And that's how you arrive at this wine. This is the Valpolicella Ripasso, which is really deep, dark, concentrated, intense wine.
Yeah, I gotta say, we'll get to it at the end, but I'm so far, just like from drinking it first last night, I feel like this is kind of a good pairing for Jabatman.
Yeah, I was having trouble pairing for this movie, and I'm still having trouble pairing for the next miniseries, because I guess my creativity has gone on hiatus for the last couple of weeks. But when I finally got to this, I was very happy with, like, as I started checking boxes and thinking about the aesthetic of the movie and thinking about how I feel about this wine, drinking this wine while watching The Batman, I think would be a very pleasant experience.
I'm very much looking forward to it because I have an extra bottle of this wine. Thank you very much. And yeah, when Jabatman comes to the HBO Max in a few weeks, or if you're listening at home, a few days ago, probably. I'm very much looking forward to watching it again. You know, there's an interesting parallel in what you're talking about, that the region and the grapes themselves, those traits would lean towards something that is not maximalist, something that is like small and elegant. Is that accurate? Me paraphrasing?
Yeah, and
there?
If you have a Bussola doesn't make a Valpolicella Classico, but if you ever have one, it's not like this. It's this, and remove the sort of jammy notes of the fruit, replace it with really fresh fruit, and dial the intensity down by about half.
Hmm. But yeah, what you made me think of is that the maximalism in terms of the style of the movie doesn't seem intuitive in terms of the take on the character. But like, this is about as far in an extreme I think you can take Batman in terms of being street level, grounded, very realistic, very naturalistic. No, like the Chris Nolan movies did that until it was time for the action scenes, and then they became like big, ridiculous, bombastic action scenes with, you know, huge fireball explosions and like unnamed cop characters who were there for comic relief just to make sure the audience knew they were supposed to be having fun. And like, this movie is so grounded and real, and we'll get to it, but like gritty and dirty and lived in its tone, and yet the style is so heightened and so turned up and so loud. And I find that parallel interesting. Like, if you describe it on paper, yes, that you would think that this would be more minimalistic. You know, like a looser camera and less emphasis on formalism and stylistic choices that draw attention to themselves. And instead it would just be about immersion. The style of this feels at odds with the tone and the realism that it's going for. I just think that's an interesting parallel.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. I hadn't thought about it that way.
But I don't think the maximalism is your problem with the movie. Your problem is the tone and the vibe, and the style maybe you're probably okay with.
Yeah, I mean, the tone and the vibe is my problem with it. And then because you turn it up to 11 with the maximalism, it becomes even more of a problem for me.
All right, next up.
Grungy.
I told you it was grungy. This one's pretty easy. The dank, Jamie, the dank. There's dank, there's grime, there's filth. You feel like Gotham is a real place that you could go and visit. You know, it feels tangible and palpable, and it's tactile. And then also on the grunge spectrum, like the Cobain of it all. I think we hear that acoustic, you know, MTV Live Unplugged, whatever recording of Something in the Way, like two, if not three times. The whole aesthetic of the character is very like grunge. Matt Reeves talked about that his conception of the character was like he's essentially like a Kurt Cobain Batman. Like what he's a tortured artist, like broken poet soul, but as
hair
Batman.
In his eyes and always on the verge of crying.
But then with his emo hair. But yeah, so that for me is the grungy. That one's super simple.
And for me, it's pretty simple too. You know, I don't think that I can draw parallels between the grunge style of music, but we're talking the Ripasso method itself is a method of reusing a waste product, something that would ordinarily go into compost or the trash, and using it to turn up the volume on something else, or maybe to distort something else. Actually, yeah, I can give it parallels to the music. You know, it's like putting distortion on a guitar.
Yeah.
Adding the Amarone skins to your regular Valpolicella juice fundamentally alters it in this kind of dirty, weird, and distorted way.
I like it. I like it a lot. And how am I tasting that grunge? What flavor note is that in the glass?
So a lot of the earthiness, also the extra tannin, that like the tongue raking tannin on this wine.
That's the grunge. That's the fuzz on Kurt Cobain's guitar.
Yeah. And then also the change in fruit character from like, and the change in fruit character is maybe the distortion, right? From what would ordinarily be like a fresh, bright Bing cherry to like a baked cherry pie kind of character.
Hmm. I like it. Okay. Next up. Red. I don't know how much we need to go into this.
Not at all, probably. The wine's red.
And the movie, like, red is a recurring, like, very significant color in the film. There's a couple of scenes that are, like, where red is the dominant or the only color that's actually in it. And the red of a, you know, emergency flare is, like, part of a signature image from the movie's climax as well.
The wine's red. The movie's red.
Red! All right, so I was trying to describe the movie in wine terms for you. I was trying to put my perception of the movie in wine language. Very bold, medium plus body. I think I meant medium plus body because the movie is thick. I feel like the movie is mouth filling. It coats the inside of one's mouth.
I'll give you that.
And high on the tannins and also dry. Dry in the sense that there is no sweetness because the movie is completely humorless, which I know is a demerit for you. I think there's like a couple of jokes in it, but you know, they're not ha ha jokes. They're like
thumb drive,
Jamie. Thumb drive. I love thumb drive.
It's good. I think I would be much more charmed by it if I liked the movie.
Yeah. Or if there were more jokes like thumb drive.
Yeah, that would definitely have helped. Yeah. And we don't really have to delve that far into it for the wine. The wine's bold. We've made the case. The wine's bold. It's got its volume turned up.
It's very bold.
It's medium plus tannin and body. It's mouth filling. It's got very present, persistent tannins, and it's fully dry. Ain't no residual sugar here.
Ain't no sugar at all. Right. This was me probably. I don't know if I said this or if you said this, but I think we definitely agree that the movie is self-important.
Yes.
I think the film, and again, like going into it, this was not the Batman movie that I wanted. And then coming out of it, it turns out that it's the Batman movie that I wanted my entire life. But that has like a 37-year-old, nigh on 40-year-old father to a child, like the last thing I wanted was a Batman movie that I wouldn't be able to share with my kid. I've seen it twice. He still doesn't know, A, that it exists, and B, that I've seen it. Because I genuinely feel guilty. Like, I, at least since I've had a kid and I've been able to share movies with him, like, I have held that these things should be, at least in part, for children. And despite the fact that there are Lego fucking sets for this movie, this is in no way, shape, or form for children at all.
Not even close. Not even a fucking little bit.
Like, as a lifelong lover of the character, and like, and I've been reading Batman comics for 30 odd years at this point, like, I have just always wanted this version on screen. It takes the concept of the character very seriously, and the internal psychology of the character it takes very seriously. And while on paper to me that sounds like something I've seen way too many times, sitting down and actually watching the thing, like, goddamn, it works. Like, that commitment works. There's an integrity to the take on the movie. And if the take doesn't resonate for you the way it doesn't resonate for you, Jamie, then that integrity kind of goes out the window. But like, for me, it totally plays in a pretty significant way.
Yeah. For me, this self-importance is the whole reason. Maybe not the whole reason, but easily 75% of the reason why I don't like this movie and why I don't like the Nolan Batman. Every part of my body wants to rebel against the take. This fundamentally to me doesn't feel like a thing that should be taken that seriously. And there are a lot of logical problems with taking it that seriously. And one of them is said out loud in this movie. I forget which character points out that Bruce is not as philanthropic as his predecessors or as his ancestors, his father, his grandfather, whomever have right. been in the past. But regardless, she calls him on, you know, not giving as much to the city. And like, for fuck's sake, that's the thing that he could be doing. And it's that's a critique on the character of Batman that I don't care about when Batman's being silly. But when Batman's being super serious and trying to do good and trying to take down villainy in Gotham, like, you can take down villainy in Gotham by preventing people from growing up in horrible orphanages and, you know, destroying poverty with your massive, incredible, disgusting wealth.
Right. And I agree with you. I do agree with you. And I think we talked about this after we walked out of the theater, which is that, like, the problem with taking a premise as ridiculous on paper as Batman, like, seriously, is that the more seriously you take it, you risk alienating the audience who just cannot buy into the premise in a grounded way. But I will say, your critique about mayoral candidate Bella Real and her calling out Bruce Wayne for his lack of philanthropy and how, you know, he could be doing better things, that is part of the text of the movie. I think it's a little bit half-baked, but like, the movie is about
it's
that.
It's one line. It's a lot half-baked in a three-hour movie.
I concur. It's one line. That is ultimately, I think, not fully paid off, but like, there's callback to it in his genuine act of heroism at the ending. Like, it, the whole movie is about him. I'm vengeance, and he wants to, you know, beat up criminals and seek out the violent ones. And then by the end has to accept that, like, oh, like, actual heroism is like putting myself on the line and trying to help people. And, you know, not to get into making the subtext, the text, Chris Nolan screenwriting territory, but like, being an actual symbol of hope and genuinely helping people and putting himself out there.
Right.
I would love more at the end of the movie, like, when now Mayor-elect Bella Real is, you know, addressing the citizens of Gotham from the top of the not New Orleans Superdome after not Katrina wipes out Gotham. But like, I would love Bruce to be there and to make an actual commitment. Like, I feel like that's the direction the movie is going, and it just gets shortchanged. But like, his privilege and his lack of engagement with the community is definitely part of the text of the film. And like, over the course of it, it's him realizing, like, oh Jesus, like, I thought I could just rest on my dad's legacy because my dad put all of our money towards helping out the city. And now I find out that the corrupt motherfuckers in City Hall have been spending this money dry and pumping it into, you know, racketeering and drugs and evil mafioso business. But like it's him coming to terms with the fact that he can't just rest on the fact that his money is going to do good on its own. He has to do good. He has to like put it in a good place. And not that I'm one of these people. I hate this. I hate this. This is always the excuse that the Marvel stands make. And I'm not that guy, Jamie. I'm not that guy. Don't put words in my mouth.
I'm not going to hold you responsible for the Marvel stands. But
all right. Not that I'm saying that it absolves the movie for that being a half-baked thematic through line. But it does feel as though a sequel is being set up in which Bruce will redirect his finances and his energies towards something other than just beating up poor people. That does not absolve the movie. It is still a half-baked element in the film, but I do feel like it is directing us towards a character who will be better about that. Like, I feel like that's the guy who we're with at the end of the movie, is someone who realizes, oh, I can be more helpful than just punching people and screaming and having a sexy voice.
Yeah. The point for me in a grounded, realistic world is that the punching people and having a gravelly, sexy voice and wearing the costume is fundamentally unhelpful, and rooting out the actual like base causes of the corruption, of the villainy, is the thing that's helpful. So for me, once again, when you take it this seriously, that's my big barrier. Once again, I don't care about that barrier if Batman is like being silly and making jokes and, you know, there are antics.
Yeah, or like fighting monsters and going to space and like fun comic book things.
Exactly. But that self-importance then creates this logical disconnect for me and frankly makes me a little mad.
I think that's a legitimate read. And as I've said, like, I think there is a time in my life in which I would have had that same response as you. But now I don't, because I'm just so desperate for one of these like billion-dollar superhero franchise movies to like have a point of view and to have a style and to be made by a director and not by a couple dozen pre-viz VFX artists who are just deciding what the whole story is going to be in pre and in post. And I forgive a lot of its flaws because of the fact that it's an actual movie. It's like a movie, and I like them. And I like when Batman is in movies and not when Batman is, you know, franchise building and part of a connected cinematic universe.
You're right. You're totally right.
But speaking of logical disconnects, so you don't like the self-importance of Batman, but this wine is self-important, and I guess that's not a detriment to you.
Yeah, I'm kind of okay with it because at the end of the day, I find it to be delicious. You know, while I would love all of the winemakers that I respond to have a little humor about themselves and, you know, understand that this is really just wine and we don't have to be fully up our own asses about the craft, you know, that just isn't the case. People seek and create meaning in their own lives in different ways. And Tommaso Bussola, who was a trained stonemason and then took over his uncle's estate, is one of these people who feels super connected to the land and talks about the wine being made in the vineyard more than in the winery, which is silly when you're talking about a wine that is this process driven, a wine that you have to do so much to, whether or not you're using additives or any of those things. It's still a thing that has to be crafted and made. And I think it's a little silly to talk about the land speaking as a primary driver of the wine when that is the case.
Jamie.
And I feel that
say
way
it.
Both about
say it. Say it.
No, I'm not going to say it.
Say it. The land is driving the wine, Jamie. Say it. Just say
I'm
it.
Not doing it. I'm what? Not going to fucking do it.
All right,
it,
fine.
Scott.
Do your best Arbat's voice, where you're like a ghostly whisper. Say it. Say it. Jamie.
I'm not engaging. They do it in Champagne and Sherry too. They talk about the Albarita soils in Sherry and the Kimmeridgian limestone in Champagne. And like, yes, those contribute to the final wine. But why are we talking? I mean, I know why we're talking so much about the terroir. It's because it fucking sells wine. but it's annoying to me in places where the process is so important. And this is also coming from someone who thinks that the people and the process is important everywhere. It just feels extra silly in these places where it's like the primary thing.
But it doesn't take away from your enjoyment of the product.
No, because at the end of the day, no matter what he says, he's still a very incredibly talented winemaker. He's obviously a talented farmer. You taste the wine in the glass and it's clean and it's beautiful. And it speaks of the skill that he has and also the place that he comes from. And it also would go really great with a steak dinner. I just think it's delicious. So yeah, I'm kind of fine with it.
I did have this with a steak last night.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, I did.
What cut of steak did you have?
I don't know. It was a sirloin.
Sirloin.
Like the size of a fillet, but the actual label said sirloin. Like it was grocery store sirloin. I'm not getting too excited about it here. I want to keep moving, but I do want to ask. So is self-importance only something that you can talk about conceptually in reference to a wine? Or can you imagine a wine that when you take a sip, you say, oh, this is self-important? Because like when I say self-important about the Batman, I'm not really talking about the, you know, meta text. I'm not talking about what Matt Reeves says in his interviews with the press.
Right. You're talking about what's on screen.
The actual movie is self-important. Is this wine, or can you conceive of a wine that in the glass you would say, oh, this is very full of itself?
Yeah, I would say that Amarone as a style feels very self-important because of the very amped up nature of it. Ripasso has a more sort of rustic kind of feel to it because it's made from a byproduct, essentially. But Amarone, because it's just this monster of a wine that's created just from the best grapes that have been picked, definitely has a feel of being full of itself. Another style of wine that I would consider to be self-important, just like in the glass, is the Parkerized, big, full, like oak-driven Cabernets of California. The ones that are 15.5% alcohol and 200% new French oak and just kind of reek of money. And it's clear that they're just there for wealthy people to have status.
But you like those wines, right? Those are your favorites.
No, I don't.
Okay. Well, good for you for not taking the bait. I'm proud of you. All right. So the next pairing phrase that we used is self-contained.
Yep.
Self-contained. So one of the many, many, many ways that this movie bucks the trend of the current glut of, you know, capes and spandex movies that are on the big screen is that it feels like a movie. A is in one singular. It is the Batman, but it is also a the Batman. It's not the Batman one, although there is, of course, going to be an inevitable sequel. While it is, of course, launching a new franchise or reiterating on a franchise that's been here for fucking 30 years, it doesn't feel like it's just launching a franchise. It's not full of setups that never go anywhere. It's not full of character cameos or, you know, franchise connected universe building bullshit. It doesn't feel like a cog in a larger machine. It is 99.9% just its own thing that's not setting up any other bullshit. And the one scene that's in it that is setting up other bullshit in my own particular headcanon doesn't exist. And I just pretend that scene doesn't happen. And when I watch the movie in the future, I don't know, maybe I'll do my own fucking obnoxious Topher Grace style fan edit. And I'll just cut that bullshit Joker scene out of the movie.
Topher Grace fan edit? Is that what's that?
He did a fan edit of the Star Wars prequels where he cut all three of them into one movie.
Really?
He has said that it like fixes a lot of the like narrative and emotional problems with it. And he cuts out, I'm assuming he cuts out all the Jar Jar and stuff. I've never watched it because I don't have time to watch that kind of nonsense.
Yeah, I ain't got it.
But I am curious about it.
Anyway, the self-contained part of like the feeling of this movie is one of the few things that I do like about it. I love that it's not dripping with something that's going to pay off two movies ahead of time.
Or not, something that just smells like it could pay off, but then ultimately never comes back, which is how most of those fucking Easter eggs and shit actually play in, for example, the Marvel movies.
For example.
For example.
Yeah, I think we both agree on that being a virtue of this movie, whether or not we like it. And, you know, when you're talking about this region, as I've said, this is a very process-driven region, and there aren't really any, there are a very small handful of places in the world where this style of wine gets made. Amarone in particular is not really a thing that happens. The ripasso method, like adding spent skins back to a lighter bodied wine to make it fuller, is a thing that happens in other places, but very, very rarely. So this is a very self-contained kind of idea in a place. And Bousselet himself is one of the few producers in this area to use new French oak. I think he's really measured in the way that he uses it. This wine has a bunch of new French oak on it, but it's not readily apparent. It just sort of rounds out the character of this wine, gives it a little bit more elegance. It's its own thing. You taste a Bousselet wine and it doesn't really taste like the other wines of the region.
Is that self-contained though, or is that just like unique and specific?
I guess it's unique and specific. The idea is contained within the region. Anyway, that's how I twisted the idea of self-contained to apply it to this wine.
All right, so you admit then that this is a contortion of the language for you to make a justification.
For sure, yeah.
All right, I'll allow it. That's fine. As long as you admit to it, Jamie, I will permit many of your sins on this podcast.
I mean, just you doing the podcast with me continually is a permission of the sins that I commit.
Fuck, I'm responsible.
You are.
I am at least tacitly endorsing your bad behavior.
That's right.
I'm very sorry, audience. Jamie, shut up for a minute. I have to talk to the audience. I apologize to all of you. I am not just subjecting you to this passively by permitting Jamie to do it, but by my continuing to work with him, I am complicit and I am responsible and I'm culpable. And I'm very sorry. I apologize.
And on behalf of the audience, I accept your apology.
Okay, so the next word that I threw at you to help come up with a pairing is assured. I believe that this is a very assured movie. Did that mean anything to you in terms of your experience of Jabatman?
Oh, yeah. In its maximalism, it speaks to a confidence to set sail in a particular direction and make no course corrections. It steps foot on a path and takes that path to the end.
Yes. Well said. It really doesn't ever cheat or diverge from that path. Yeah, I mean, you said it spot on with the maximalism. The stylistic choices are very bold and very outside of convention for the genre. This is easily the best looking superhero movie since, I don't know, your mileage may vary, but like probably since the Tim Burton Batman movies.
Yeah.
And I'm not just talking about Batman movies. I just mean like superhero movies in general. Like some of them look good. It's Eye of the Beholder, but like some people think the Zack Snyder movies look really good. I don't care for his aesthetic, but like it's a strong aesthetic. But I just think this one has a way better look and it commits very hard to that look in that it looks like a film, like a movie film made for adults by adults. But even beyond that, like there's a confidence in the content of the movie. Like it's a 3-hour Batman movie and there's not very much action to it. And there is a confidence and assuredness there that I find very refreshing, even to the genre conventions. Like to make a tentpole franchise launching superhero movie and to not have very much action, to not have the typical superheroic jokes and tone and references and Easter eggs and bullshit for the fans that would make it not self-contained, I think is a huge, confident, assured swing. And then that commitment to the tone and to the pace, like the movie is long, but not because it ends with a 45-minute long, like CGI bullshit battle. Like it's long because it has a lot of story. And I think there's some problems with the story, but like it commits to the story that it wants to tell and commits to unfolding it at a very particular pace. And I think they largely pull it off.
I disagree with the last part, but everything else I agree with.
Well, that's okay because you're dumb and you're a butt.
Did you just call me a butt?
You are a butt.
I'm Jamie. I have a butt.
You are a butt.
That is not a nice thing to say.
All right, fine. I'm cutting that out of the show because it wasn't nice, and I'm trying to be nice. I'm trying.
This is absolutely cut out of the show. You're going to leave that one in.
I'm cutting it out 100%, along with everything you've ever said on the show, because I feel bad for the audience because I'm complicit. But it feels like the work of a singular voice, and a very confident one, and one whose voice is not compromised by a studio that, you know, becomes afraid of people doing different things with their $1 billion, you know, merchandising cash cows.
Yeah. And I agree with that. And it's one of the things that I respond to in this movie. I like that it has a singular voice. I don't necessarily like that voice. But I like that we can talk about it and that there's a discussion to be had.
Yeah. I mean, I saw this when you and I saw it. That was my second time seeing it. And then a few days later, I watched Spider-Man No Way Home, which is just the philosophical opposite of this movie, which just looks like nothing and feels like nothing and is just like gray, extruded, homogenized corporate product out of the tube. And Is it flavored product, Scott? I don't even know if it's flavored like anything, Jamie. It's just product.
Hot takes from Scotty. Spider-Man No Way Home. Garbage.
Sorry, everybody. I'm sorry so many of you got COVID so you could go see that piece of shit in theaters. And I'm really glad that you all enjoyed it. And I genuinely am glad that people had a very emotional response to like a toothpaste tube that squeezes out gray caulk. But it is a nothing. It is 2.5 hours of nothing. And I'm a little horrified at its success and its acclaim. But I digress.
You do digress.
Jamie, tell me about the assured nature of this here bottle of police wine.
It's not police wine, goddammit. Valpolicella is what it's called. Motherfucker. Anyway, the Busola wines have been made in this style since the beginning. Tommaso took over his uncle's estate in 95, released the first wines in 99. I started tasting these wines in 2011, and since then they've been done in exactly the same style, even as tastes within the wine community and the world community at large have gone from that over-parkerized, really extracted version to something seeking a little bit more balance. These wines continue to walk the path that they're on. And each vintage is just a story of how, you know, the year affected the grapes. And it's less about the choices that Tommaso is making in the winery, because it's just a very steady style of winemaking. And it takes a lot of confidence to continue to do that year after year, knowing that tastes continue to change the world over.
I have another parallel.
Yeah.
Can you indulge me in a parallel?
You shall be indulged.
Because I feel that in terms of the confidence of this take on Batman feels very much like Matt Reeves, writer director, decided, I'm going to pretend that no one ever made a Batman movie before. So much with these franchises, it's something people have always said about the James Bond movies, that every Bond movie is a reaction to the previous Bond movie, or a reaction to the response of the previous Bond movie. But because these super franchises keep getting rebooted now, like we've had 3 Spider-Man and 5 or 6 Batman and so on and so on and so on, that they're always responding to the previous iteration. And like one of the things that the MCU, Marvel, Sony collaboration, Tom Holland, Spider-Man movies did was like, we're not going to do things that people have seen before. So like they made an intentional choice. We're not going to do an origin story, which is great, except when the origin story is so ultimately foundational to the fucking character. And how do you possibly wait until 2.5 movies into a Spider-Man series to have someone say to him, with great power comes great responsibility?
Right.
It's madness to me. This movie is not a reaction to what came before. It's not going in an opposite direction, like an opposite direction from the Ben Affleck Batman in Batman v Superman and the various iterations of Justice League, and to the Chris Nolan, Christian Bale Batman. The opposite version of that would not be this. It would be a Batman who, you know, has a Robin and smiles and tells jokes and fights robots and, you know, time travels and like fun comic book shit.
That's the one I want to see.
And I would love to see that as well. I would very much love to see that on the big screen. I don't think Pattinson is the guy to do it, but damn, if I wouldn't love to see him try. But like Reeves is so committed and so assured in his take on the character that he's willing to do things that feel very familiar. Like, there are times in this movie, and I felt it all throughout the marketing, where it was like, yeah, that looks kind of cool and I like the look of it, but it just looks like more of the Chris Nolan thing where we're going to do a movie about, you know, moral decay and corruption in a crumbling urban environment, and it's going to be grounded and realistic, and I'm just like so over it. And this movie does that and does many other things with it stylistically and emotionally and narratively that like really pay off for me. But it's kind of what you're saying about like that this winemaker has resisted all of the trends that are around them, and they just keep making the same thing with that same level of confidence. Like, this movie resists the trend of veering in the opposite direction of what the genre or what that particular franchise iteration has done, even possibly to its own detriment. Like, I feel that like this movie is going to age better the further we get from very similar versions of Batman that have happened in the last 10 years.
I think you're probably right about that. Even for me, as someone who doesn't particularly like this movie, I can imagine coming back to it 10 or 15 years from now and having a totally different experience.
Our next and second to the last pairing term, this is one that I threw at you, is that J-Batman, Le Batman, The Batman, wears its references openly. Did that do anything for you? Did that mean anything for you in reference to this particular motion picture?
Yes, it does. And especially when we're talking about Bussola specifically. Do you want me to go first?
No, I don't care about that. I'm saying, did that mean anything to you in terms of the movie that you had just watched?
Sort of, but like I don't have the context that you do on movies.
Yeah.
So like I've never seen Chinatown.
Jamie.
I know.
Jamie. Scott, I know. Jamie.
Scott, I know.
It has a lot of like touchstones, and you couldn't swing a dead cat on the internet in February of 2022 and not hit an interview in which Matt Reeves like wanted to name drop a bunch of his references, which I did find a little bit tiresome, but also the guy's on the fucking publicity trail for a movie. I get it. You have to find something to talk about. There are lensing choices in the movie that are very evocative of Chinatown, that like a lot of distortion in the anamorphic lenses and the way that light bends and the use of shadows, the, you know, lone detective trying to get to the bottom of corruption. The look of it kind of feels like a lot of the Alan J. Pakula 70s noirs, like All the President's Men or Clute. But then the references I'm really talking about beyond just visual are to David Fincher serial killer movies. Seven, which this movie feels extremely indebted to in its look and its vibe and the sense of like a hell mouth of a city that's ready to swallow up all of its denizens. And then Zodiac, like Zodiac is another 3-hour movie about a serial killer who barely appears in the film, and that it's all really about how like the search for the truth and the search for the real suspect will ultimately destroy the lives of everybody who's searching for them. There are like very explicit, borderline not even homages to Seven and Zodiac in the movie. Like the scene after they find the Riddler's apartment, right? And they go in there and they're looking at all of his like journals and all of his like insane ramblings and these like tiny, you know, chicken scratch scrawl in these journals that he does for every single day is like explicitly a scene in Seven where they finally find Kevin Spacey's apartment before we even know that it's Kevin Spacey, who turned out to somehow be even more of a monster in real life than he was in that movie.
I rewatched Moon the other day and
the
movie's beautiful, but every time I like clock the voice as Kevin Spacey.
Yeah.
It's tough.
The Kevin Spacey of it all is only a problem in movies like Moon, where he is supposed to be like warm and likable.
Yeah.
And then it doesn't work. But like I watch something like Seven and I'm like, okay, I have no problem imagining fucking piece of shit rapist Kevin Spacey as a serial killer murderer. Like this is perfectly fine. We kind of should have known the whole time, honestly. But yeah, and then even like the Zodiac of it all, beyond just like the narrative like length and the thematic thrust of it, is like the Paul Dano Riddler looks very much like the Zodiac garb that was so famously described in like a police sketch by two of his victims, and that is depicted in one of the more chilling scenes in that entirely chilling movie. Jamie, have you seen Zodiac? Have you watched The Zodiac?
I have not seen Zodiac.
Jamie!
I know, Scott.
All right, all right. Instead of clockwork oranging you into watching The Batman over and over again until you like it, instead, just come up and I'll show you a different 3-hour serial killer procedural. But that is all to say that this movie very much openly like flaunts its references to a degree that I almost find annoying sometimes.
This part doesn't bother me. I like that Gotham looks like Seven, as you say.
Yeah.
That it's this open wound of a city. I do like dig that aesthetic. But this wine also, I think, wears its references openly.
Oh yeah, I picked up on all the references while I was drinking it. I totally understand what they're talking about.
What references are you getting there, Scott?
Well, so the red, Jamie, is in reference to other wines made from red grapes. And the body is them talking about, you know, the larger socio-political, you know, body versus no body. Man, I got nothing. Why you got to call me out on that? Let me just say dumb shit sometimes.
Because it's fun.
Yeah.
It's a little fun. The audience likes when either of us like stammers about something.
Well, then they should hear the unedited versions of these episodes. My God, they would be so happy with all the stammering that's left in.
That's true. It maybe one day.
No.
We'll just release a supercut of stammering.
Well, no, instead, just maybe one day we'll get good at being broadcasters and then I won't have to spend so much time cutting out all the parts where we go, or
We get a little better each time.
I think.
So this wine for me is the Busola wines in general, while they definitely speak of the region and the place that they are, or the process that is traditional to make Amarone and Valpolicella Ripasso, the fact that new French oak is involved and the sort of the texture of the tannins and the refinement that is here references in my eyes, Bordeaux specifically. This is kind of a Bordeaux styled wine. It's buttoned up. It is elegant. While still being powerful, the tannins specifically are, you know, we talked about them being persistent, but fine-grained, not that like sandpaper kind of feel to them. I referenced the stylistic divide in this region, the Del Forno as the modernist and the Quintarelli as the traditionalist. In the Quintarelli wines, you see a lot more oxidation, a lot more of that rusticity that I was talking about, a little bit of volatility, some volatile acidity. And in the Del Forno wines, it's very sort of hermetically sealed. And there's a technique that goes into making this wine that I think makes its texture, makes the tannins different from both of those wines, which is rather than using punch downs to manage the cap during fermentation, the Busola winery uses pump overs. And I know I'm introducing some new vocabulary here.
So what are the punch downs? What are the pump ups?
So when you're making red wine, you leave the skins in the juice during fermentation. We've established this at least on the podcast.
We have.
And that's what gives you color and tannin. If you don't employ any method of what's called cap management, basically you're going to end up with a fucked up wine. Naturally, the cap, which is all of the solids, in the wine, all of the skins, if you leave stems in, that kind of thing, will naturally come to the top during fermentation. This is because during fermentation, you're letting off a lot of CO2, which pushes the solids to the top. When the top of that dries out, it allows air in and can allow fungus or other bacteria to grow. So in order to mitigate that, you can either punch down using your hands, your feet, or a big stick to sort of stir up your fermenter, or you can use a pump to more gently sort of spray wine over the top of the cap and keep it damp and keep it not exposed to that oxygen. The latter technique allows for a more gradual extraction of tannin. And that's what is on display here. And that is what I believe the reference is. This is a more Bordeaux-styled Valpolicella.
This is something I've never thought about before because I never, it never occurred to me to think of wine this way. But the references from one bottling or like one vintner to another, does that ever veer into like annoying for you? Because as I'm saying with the Batman, like, I love the whole Seven aesthetic of it and the Zodiac vibe of it. But then the scenes that are explicitly evoking what are, for me, very memorable scenes from those movies, I find distracting. I find, like, you know, it's you're calling attention to it at best, and at worst, you're just stealing a scene from one of your influences. And I can find that kind of grating. Do you ever have any kind of parallel there?
Yes. I think the one that bothers me the most is when American winemakers try and make European wine in America. It always bugs me when a producer in California picks so early that the wine feels underripe and maybe a little bit hollow, all in pursuit of this structure and high acidity that you can get in Europe, but completely ignoring the fact that you're in California and you should be embracing that intense California sunshine and fruit that you can get. I think that winemakers should pursue balance in their wines, but I don't think that they should ignore the features of the places that they are growing grapes in.
Right. They shouldn't ignore the That's really important.
Stop it. Yes, the place is important. And once again, so are the people. And we should not ignore either of those things.
Hmm. Jamie's allowing for nuance today, everyone. He's allowing for nuance, and I appreciate that, because I, too, enjoy nuance.
It's true. The Batman does not love nuance, though.
I think there's plenty of nuance in the movie.
There's a little.
There's a healthy portion of nuance in the movie. You know, it's also like a Batman movie, and it's big and blunt and maximalist and thundering in your ears. But I think there's also nuance in the characters and the characterization and the themes and the relationships, too. It's just like the craziest thing that you said to me when we walked. Yeah, I heard that fart noise. Very good. You're a big boy now, Jamie. Almost 40, or almost 40, almost 40, still making fart noises on microphone. Good for you.
It's because you said the relationships. I think the relationships in this fucking movie suck.
Oh my God, the relationships are so good. The Bruce Alfred relationship, I agree, is underserved, and I could have used more of it, but like,
it's nothing.
It's not nothing. It's something.
It's something that's like rote and almost like just playing service to the fact that we kind of know that Alfred exists. Like this movie could be fine without him. Just having him there, I think, is a distraction.
I do agree that having him there is a distraction just because the thing is so overstuffed and Alfred does feel obligatory in it. But the actual relationship between the two men, I found very compelling. I found Alfred
to be exactly the same as I've seen it portrayed basically always.
That is just patently untrue. It's patentsonly untrue. Jamie.
Wow. God damn it.
Yeah. Yeah. I was just waiting to crack that one out. No, that's
I
not true.
Hate it.
That just came to me off the top of my head. But also the Bruce Selina relationship. Like you didn't feel that there was any chemistry between them, which is insane.
It's a yawn. It's a snooze fest. It's two hot people who don't find each other hot.
Oh my God, they're just two sad, broken children who recognize something broken and wrong inside the other, and she's able to express it better than he is, and he all of his, like, broken little boy, like, the way that he emotes without the mask translates into something that she finds sexy when he's in the costume, but he's still like barely able to make eye contact, but he's so compelled by the fact that she is the only person who looks at him when he's in the costume and isn't repulsed or terrified or like pity him. It's not in the dialogue as much, but just in their relationships and their physicality and the blocking of the scenes, like the way that they relate to each other, I found super hot and also super heartbreaking.
Yeah, I can't see any of it. I just saw two hot people who were standing near each other and felt like it was obligatory to kiss one another.
Mm.
And the kiss felt, both kisses felt heatless and bizarre.
The second one felt bizarre to me. Neither one felt heatless, but you know, we're here to discuss our differing opinions on it.
It's true.
And that's okay, Jamie. That's okay. Next time on the podcast, Johnny Words is going to come on and we're just going to scream about The Matrix Resurrections for six more episodes.
That's part seven of our 52-part miniseries.
No, that's a joke. Next time on, in all true, Johnny Words is going to come on, and I'm going to scream about Dune for, you know, until Dune Part 2 comes out, and maybe I'll
I will bow out of that recording.
You saw Dune. You watched a Dune. You like a Dune.
I did, and I agree with you. I don't love it.
Yeah.
It just kind of happened and it was a thing and I'm not upset about it, but I'm also not excited about it. And if there weren't any discourse, I would probably forget about it.
Yeah. I mean, this is again, part of why I wanted to talk about this movie is that your reaction to The Batman is very much my reaction to Dune, which is like, and maybe I'm putting words in your mouth, but like aesthetically, I found it so electrifying and narratively and emotionally, I just thought it was completely inert and did nothing for me. And it kind of made me mad.
Correct.
And again, like I could see myself having the exact same reaction to this movie, but you know, our opinions change over time. Our opinions and our takes and our feelings change with time. Like I feel like I've talked about it on the show before, probably in our 17-hour Tenet miniseries. But my relationship to Chris Nolan's 2008 The Dark Knight has been very complicated, and I've like kind of come around on it in a big way, in part because I have forgiven it for not being the Batman movie that I wanted and for not being just in general the movie that I was trying to force it to be. And I kind of accept it for what it is, warts and all. We must allow a thing to be that which it is, and we must allow others to not enjoy the thing that which it is.
That is correct. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Live and let live, as they say.
Which is why Spider-Man No Way Home being the number three movie at the domestic box office of all time during the peak of a pandemic is something that I allow and don't judge anyone for. And it doesn't upset me at all or keep me up at night.
Scott is he's saying all of this through gritted teeth. Y'all.
I'm actually vomiting into my own mouth right now. It's
head is literally on fire.
Yeah. Well, you know what's going to help put that fire out? A little bit of rain, a little bit of April showers. So the last thing that I said to Jamie, and this was me just being a little bit funsies and also throwing some, you know, Jamie-style vocabulary words back at him, is that I described the movie as having a petrichor quality because it's always raining in Gotham City.
It is. It is. And I have to point out to you, Scotty, too hottie, that petrichor is the smell of the air just as it starts to rain. It's the odor that is given off by little fungal guys in the soil or on the streets, right as the water begins to fall, which then sort of dissipates. And it's always raining in Gotham, so the smell of Gotham would be saturated and rotten, you big idiot.
Okay, well, shut up. And let me amend to say that it's almost always raining in Gotham City. It is not always raining. It is raining probably 50% of the time in Gotham City.
But it's always wet.
Well, it is always wet. But then, you know, if it's not always raining, then at some point it's got to be the time right before it starts raining when the fungal pressure comes out and the petrichor smell comes out. Therefore, this is an excellent pairing word.
It's a really bad pairing word.
There's a handful of scenes where it's not raining. Therefore, since it's always raining in the next scene, petrichor.
It has to be dry first in order for you to get petrichor.
All right. Well, clearly Gotham has a water drainage problem issue.
Yes, it does.
As figures prominently
as is highlighted
in the finale.
By the fact that it floods at the very end of the movie.
Hey, man, that was his plan. He's a terrorist. Just you wait. Soon enough, we're going to see Riddler was right t-shirts. And then if I see up in the next movie, that's how I'll know that I never want to watch a movie ever again. It's just tangent. The Marvel people have co-opted. I'm sure you've seen, even though you haven't seen the last two Avengers movies, but like you've seen the memes and the social media jokes or not jokes about how Thanos was right.
Yes.
Well, and now that's keeps coming up. There's a Thanos was right joke apparently in the Disney Plus Hawkeye show, and there's a Mysterio was right character in Spider-Man No Way Home. It's the Matrix, Jamie. It's the Matrix. It's the simulation weaponizing the critiques of itself. It's the Marvel Disney evil fucking mouse is just taking all the memes and incorporating it in a completely substance-free way into their movies. And it makes me want to vomit. Because also Thanos is not right. The way that you solve economic disparity and a lack of fundamental like supplies and needs for the populace and for population growth is not to cut the population in half, because once you get to 1 billion people, it's 100 years until you're at 8 billion people. Like, come on, Thanos, do the fucking math, dog.
Are you done?
Yeah, I think so. I think I'm all right now.
Okay, good. I'm glad you got that out of your system.
So Is there a pre-rain petrichor stank on this wine?
No. There's a saturated, rotten kind of the smell of dank earth, that like wet mulch thing that you were talking about, and that early spring wet forest floor kind of thing that I was talking about earlier. That's what is in this movie. So I ignored your incorrect note about petrichor and changed it into the real like rotted earth wetness that I think exists on the streets of Gotham and in this wine.
Well, you're welcome, Jamie. You just played into my master villainous plan. I completely anticipated your contrarian ways, and that you would try and reverse. And this is my Heath Ledger Joker magical plan, where I can always anticipate all the nuances of human behavior as though they were simple logic puzzles to be solved.
Thank you, Thano Mysterio.
I got you.
Yes.
Okay. Well,
so we did it.
We did it. We talked about Batman. We talked about this wine. I think I convinced Jamie that this is actually a great movie. Jamie says 10 stars out of 10. And, you now all have our glowing endorsement to go and watch Batman, which again, probably on HBO Max as of you're listening to this episode.
You should, by the way, you should watch this movie with the warning that if you have inclinations toward whimsy, you will not find it here.
Right. If you want all things to be whimsical the way that Jamie does, where Jamie isn't allowed, but you want variety in
Batman
the things that you consume.
Batman should be whimsical, though. Like, but it's fucking Batman.
But
it's
Batman
a comic
doesn't
book
have to be whimsical. All right. I don't have a double feature for the audience, but I will say, because this is very funny that this is the opposite direction that this is coming from. If you enjoy the Batman, and even if you're like Jamie and you don't enjoy this particular take on the Batman, I would enjoy everybody go out and grab a copy of Glenn Weldon's book, The Caped Crusade, Batman and the Rise of Nerd Culture. Glenn Weldon writes for NPR. He is a comic book expert. As far as I'm concerned, he wrote the definitive book on Batman. And it is a pop culture deconstruction of the many, 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 many versions of Batman over the decades since his inception in the late 1930s in the comic book form. And one of the many theses in the book is that there's been this like calcified, codified vision that like since the late 80s that Batman can only be the brooding, dark, vengeful, leg-breaking, growling, loner vigilante of the urban night, as depicted in Frank Miller's like seminal works of Year One and The Dark Knight Returns. And it has just become like the standard in the comics and is increasingly what Batman movie fans scream for and clamor for. They want The Dark Knight. They don't want Batman and Robin. They love fucking Zack Snyder's Batflack, who, you know, just straight up murders a bunch of people and is not a good characterization, though I kind of like the performance. Jamie is coming at it from the opposite stance, which is that Batman can only be one thing, which is whimsical. And the Glenn Weldon take is largely that, like, no, all versions of Batman are canonical. They're all legitimate. Eventually on the show, at some point, we will maybe do an episode on the Lego Batman movie, which feels like it takes the Glenn Weldon book as the thesis statement, which is it takes all versions of Batman and say that they are all canon and that they're all legitimate. And it shows that the super serious, gritty, up his own ass version of Batman is actually the most hysterical and ridiculous. And we'll get there eventually. And Jamie, you own a copy of that book, so you should read it again and shut the fuck up.
I may do the first part. I will definitely not do the second part.
All right. Well, I think the book is on tape because I know you can't read.
This fucking joke.
It's got legs.
Keeps on going.
Just like the Batman with its 3-hour runtime.
It was exhausting.
I really like it. It doesn't feel like 3 hours to me. So Jamie, yes. Surprise. It's been a while. We have wife takes. We have holy wife takes, boy. Batman.
Holy wife takes, Batman.
From wife, who, by the way, also really very much liked this movie. So that's two of us against one of you, and you're a butt. So my
this
wife
is
Tot,
the second time this episode you've called me a butt, and I don't like it.
Well, it's the 100% of this episode that you've been a butt, so deal with it.
Not nice.
So this is a podcast game recreating my wife Tani's favorite way to antagonize James at his restaurants back when he
my
worked at
Jamie.
Them and shut up, and we attended them. Wherein she would order wines and then try to come up with her own flowery, pretentious descriptions of the wines to rival and, in fact, ridicule his delicate somme sensibilities.
Nothing about me is delicate.
Shut up. So for today, she has two questions for you, Jamie. First, What element from the movie The Batman does this wine most closely resemble? A. Vengeance. B. Justice. C. A Regency-style romance evoked almost entirely through eye contact.
Well, it's definitely not C. Let's go with vengeance.
You think it's A, vengeance?
Vengeance.
Tani says A, vengeance is too simple. B is too nuanced.
Oh my God.
And C is just the right amount of complicated with hints of smolder and spice.
Oh God.
I can like hear her giggling as she typed that out. She was so pleased with herself.
She and I are going to have words the next time we meet.
That's okay. She has better words than you do.
I hate that she has better words than I do.
Her follow-up question is just an open-ended prompt. Of all the iterations of Batman, I'm assuming she means all of the big screen cinematic iterations of Batman, whose costume does this wine most resemble and why? So we gotta go back. Let's assume fairly that neither Jamie or I have seen the 1940s serial version of Batman, which looks like the saddest version of the Halloween costume that I wore in 1990.
Right.
And we'll sidestep that one. So we've got your 1989, 1992 Michael Keaton Batman, which is like a poured rubber latex thing.
With a yellow and black emblem.
And then you've got your variations on the chiseled ab beefcake nipple suits worn by Val Kilmer and George Clooney in the Joel Schumacher movies. And then you're like various utilitarian SWAT fascist tactical suits worn by Christian Bale, or the like, I don't even know how to describe the Zack Snyder Batman suits, or then the Pat's costume, which just is fucking awesome.
It's so good.
And sexy. And the mask is so good and so expressive. And yeah. So of all of those, Jamie, which does this wine most resemble and why?
I've got to go with the Pat's costume, partly because it's the one that I like the most, with the exception of the Michael Keaton one, which I really do love. I love the flash of it all. And even the fact that he can't move at all gives it a particular aesthetic.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's the way this wine is. I think this wine is more lithe and expressive in the way that the Pat's costume is.
And it's smoky, and I don't know, maybe this is just 2.5 glasses and a lot of suggestibility, but there's like a leathery quality to the wine. Yeah. And like his mask is just like this molded leather thing that looks incredible. And I just don't know why it took 30 years after the 1989 Tim Burton movie for somebody to say, huh, what if his head wasn't covered in poured latex that not only restricted mobility, but also made his noggin look enormous. And as a man with an enormous noggin, I have to really feel bad for Batman because, you know, it just makes your shoulders look small.
Yeah. And if you had a poured latex cowl over your big noggin,
I wouldn't be able to lift my head.
All right. We've done it. We've reached the end.
All right, Jamie, do you feel satisfied? Should we do a whole 6-part miniseries on the Batman? You liked it that much, right? We should do more episodes on the Batman.
Please no.
All right, fine.
Anyway, everyone, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
It's always a pleasure to podcast with y'all. It's only sometimes a pleasure to podcast with Scott. Please follow us on the socials at Bigger Bottle Pod. Email us with questions, concerns, comments at biggerbottlepod@gmail.com. Please make sure you rate, review, and follow the show wherever you get your podcasts. Also, please tell a friend about the show.
This episode, as all of our episodes, was produced and edited by me, that's Scott Hudson, and our social media presence is thanks to Jamie Harrison Rubin, that is him virtually right across from me. Our new art that you're all enjoying is the fine contribution of a friend of ours, Ross Kennard. Thank you very much, Ross.
Remember, everyone, drink more wine and watch more movies. It's good for you. We promise.
Man, I'm starting to get used to that. I'm trying to prevent the existential crisis that happened when I turned 30 from again happening when I'm 40. So I'm just like describing myself as nearly 40 more often recently. And I feel like it's helping. It doesn't make me feel good, but I feel like the transition from 39 to 40 will be easier as a result of this.
You had an existential crisis at 30?
Jamie, I threw myself a 2-day long birthday party to distract from the fact that I was turning over the decades.
No, that's right.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I'm Jamie.
I don't think I was able to attend either of those days.
No, you did. You did.
Did I?
Yeah, you told me you weren't going to be able to, and then you came down.
That's right.
That's right.
And then you threw me a surprise party.
Did I?
For my 30th. Yeah, you did. Or at least you took part in the surprise.
When was that? Where was that?
That was February. That was in Philly. A gathering of people at Watkins. And you had me. We were over in West Philly.
And we had everybody surprise you upstairs in like the pool room.
Yep.
That is
And I called
correct.
You on it in the drive over to Watkins. I was like, this is a surprise party, isn't it? And wow. You hopped to it. And
I got really drunk that night because I have very little recollection of this evening. I remember being in the room and I remember having to explain to some people that, no, you have to go downstairs to order your drinks. And I remember somebody knocking over a glass and that being about it. Wow. That was a good one, I think. I'm pretty sure that was a good time.
I remember most of that night, despite the fact that the 2 days after represented my first ever 48-hour hangover.
That's right. That's right. I'm saying that's right. I really don't remember. I must have really drank a lot that night.
Yep.
Oh, boy.